chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make the heaven in the middle of it. Rest make the heaven in the middle. We are. Rest make the heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off with a Greg Reese, proclamation here, announcement about usury and banks and so forth. They're having problems over in China of people not being able to get their money out of some of the banks over there. So here we go with Greg Reese.
The Bank of China told their depositors that their savings accounts are now investment products and can no longer be withdrawn. And to stop the people from trying to withdraw their money, the CCP deployed tanks. Banks all over the world are imploding. And within this great reset, there is great opportunity for mankind, so long as we recognize who the real perpetrators are. The word apocalypse simply means the lifting of the veil, a revelation of truth, or in modern terms, the Great Awakening. Mankind is now awakening to the fact that we have been lied to and exploited as chattel for, at the very least, our entire lifetimes. And one of the most valuable truths to be gleaned from the Great Awakening, as far as human civilization is concerned, is who is responsible. It's crucial to identify who is responsible so that we can stop it from happening again, because the enemy likes to hide. There is nothing new under the sun, and all we have to do is follow the money, which leads us directly to the Federal Reserve banking system and their conglomerate of associates known as the big banks. We can trace the big banks back to Mayor Rothschild, who famously said, "Give me control of a nation's money supply, and I care not who makes its laws." And he was likely speaking about the usury laws that for centuries prevented people from charging interest on loans because it was considered theft. If all men are created equal, then the banks should be acting more like a service industry, not profiting off other people's debt. But Mayor Rothschild was able to bypass these usury laws because the Rothschild banking dynasty was merely a front for the royal bloodlines. As the old world order adapted their schemes for the Industrial Revolution, the Rothschild banking dynasty began running central banks for kings throughout Europe. And in America, they partnered with the Morgans to create the Federal Reserve banking system, which would normalize usury and debt for generations to come. For millennia, usury was considered immoral and denounced by major religions and philosophers. But today, it's completely normal in the West to be broken by debt and at the same time considered successful. But this is new. Many places still see usury as a crime against humanity. Libya had gone from one of the poorest countries to the richest in Africa by creating its own bank backed by gold and silver and no usury. By 2011, the people of Libya were beginning to know real wealth, and Gaddafi was about to spread this model throughout all of Africa. But the old world order had other plans, and so Libya was looted and destroyed. The big banks and their royal inbred masters are responsible for the entire clown show we are seeing today. The Rockefeller family's Big Pharma engineered the COVID pandemic as a black swan event to collapse the world economy so that the old world order can discreetly become the new world order. They are orchestrating the radical LGBTQ agenda as a smokescreen to confuse you, while using Joe Biden and the United Nations 2030 agenda as scapegoats for the collapse of the U.S. dollar. Because these inbred crooks plan on staying in power, and they need someone else to blame when they come to our rescue with a new financial system. Fortunately, this great awakening has revealed that we no longer need the old world order's big banks. We now have over a decade of cryptocurrency stress testing that proves we don't need centralized banking. And we have centuries of stress testing that prove the stability of gold and silver. The new world order is just the old world order, a cabal of parasite crime families feeding off of humanity. And if we fail to take control of our own destiny now, then the new world order will succeed and mankind will be eradicated. The choice is ours, and there won't be a second chance. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
Alex just blew open a quite a news, you could say, headlines. Talking with Robert Barnes earlier in the week, it was revealed that Trump and DeSantis have a secret agreement that Trump will run for president, DeSantis will be his vice president. Ticket on the Republican side. So here they go, and they speak a little bit about that. But also, what's important about this interview is about emergency powers, okay? Our Constitution had no provision for emergency powers, and they've invented these kinds of things through executive orders, and this is very dangerous for our country. But anyway, listening to this interview, it's very interesting. But also, Trump and DeSantis are running mates.
By the way, this hasn't hit the news yet.
No, it isn't. It isn't public, but it will be by the time. It probably won't be fully public until the convention. But the agreement is already there behind the scenes for Trump and DeSantis to run on a ticket.
Beautiful.
In 2024. And that's why all these people talking about DeSantis challenging him, totally false. That's totally fake news.
Beautiful.
The only way anything like that happens is if Trump has a health problem or something else.
Well, I'm beside myself happy right now.
Well, not only that, DeSantis is also insurance. Right now, the only reason why Trump hasn't announced this ticket is while DeSantis is out there, he's also indictment insurance for Trump because Democrats are as scared of Trump. So they're like, well, if we take out Trump, we're stuck with DeSantis, and maybe we get doubly whacked. So the it provides perfect cover. Ultimately, they'll run.
He's got to make sure they're never on the same airplane together.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Don't take an LBJ special trip to Dallas, Texas in November. You might be okay. So the agreement's already there for 2024 to be a Trump-DeSantis ticket. DeSantis knows that Trump can only serve one term, so that he would be in a position to have two terms himself come 2028. It perfectly aligns for what DeSantis wants to achieve. It also aligns with what Trump wants to achieve. The second aspect of this Trump-DeSantis ticket would be how they govern. That DeSantis would be given a lot of authority over domestic issues and domestic aspects, because that isn't where Trump's focus is. Trump's focus is on international relations, of defeating globalists and globalism, of restoring peace and prosperity around the world and at home, and that is where his instincts and skill set excel. It's the one place where DeSantis is frankly kind of weak and unknown at this point. So it perfectly aligns with both of their institutional interests, their individual interests, their political interests, their ideological interest, and so that agreement is already there. It won't be announced until much later, and the reason for that is DeSantis is indictment insurance for Trump, because Democrats are terrified of a DeSantis candidacy as much as they are terrified of a Trump candidacy, and consequently, they know if they can't take out DeSantis, then they're not going to try to take out Trump at a federal indictment level, and that's the real reason they're not going to indict Trump federally.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are at an amazing moment. We are watching the deep state in full panic. The Supreme Court 3 weeks ago ruled that government agencies can't just make rulings outside of law and shut down all U.S. energy. Biden said he would counter it with executive action and announced executive orders yesterday that he would release this morning. He released a 52-page climate president's emergency powers. The climate president's emergency powers that says all exports banned. That alone is the most insane blockade against America I've ever heard of. That alone is so bombshell, I'm like dizzy. Then he says no more oil exploration. Then he says we're going to outlaw combustion engines. I showed this 5 times the last 2 hours. I mean, I can't even believe it myself. If you're listening on radio and you don't believe me, you shouldn't. You should go look at this for yourself. Got a link to it in the live show feed. and then it gets worse from there. This is a climate dictatorship, nothing to do with the climate. It's all about a power grab. Then he said at 12:45, 30 minutes ago, or 25 minutes ago, that they were going to have a speech this morning. They said it was canceled. Then, I guess they had to rewrite his announcement. Now they announced coming up in an hour he's going to give a speech. So they are disjointed, confused, running around like chickens with their heads cut off, trying to implement this globalist agenda. The constitutional lawyer Robert Barnes is here with us in studio to lay this out and so much more today coming up. But Barnes, your take on this.
Well, I don't think they can give Joe Biden enough brain force to recover from his dementia, so we'll see how he does in an hour. But what we have is what we talked about all the way back 2 years ago when all this started with the pandemic lockdowns and the emergency powers. Goes all the way back to the Weimar Constitution in Germany, goes back to what happened here in the United States and the trilogy of infamy of cases in the beginning of the 20th century. Emergency powers pose the greatest risk and the greatest threat to constitutional liberties and freedoms that can possibly exist in the last century plus, both in the United States and in Europe and around the globe. And we said if this Pandora's box is opened, they're going to keep going back and reopening it and reopening it and reopening it over and over and over again for whatever they want, for whatever power grab is their latest power grab. This climate emergency set of orders that he's talking about is patently unconstitutional. To give an example, this goes back to the U.S. Supreme Court has already said the CDC can't use its public health authority to regulate tenant-landlord relationships in local areas. And yet they're talking
about shows the CDC power grab. It's just they can't help it.
Exactly. And yet here they are going back, declaring that they can monitor what is in your car, what is in your home, how much you use your car. They're talking about using individual sanctions.
That's why they passed last year the law for tracking computers in all cars.
Exactly.
And it even says here, no investment allowed in fossil fuels by executive order, like we're a foreign country.
Precisely. And it also goes to, we talked about at the beginning when they started doing these sanctions against random people connected to Russia, that they would misuse and abuse that power, and they're doing that as well. They're citing sanctions power to say they can go after individuals, again, for things that have never passed legislation, never gone through the court process, never gone through. I mean, they're basically you're taking the way in which they have rigged other.
There's five pages on the office of the president, and they list other agencies will ban investment in fossil fuel outside of law. I mean, what? Who's going to enforce that?
That's what happens when you allow these individual sanctions. So first they did it in the name of the pandemic. Then they did it in the name of Ukraine. And in both contexts, they were using it as testing grounds to see how much they could just universally and unilaterally assert power that deprives all of the rule of law so that there's no court protection, no legislative process. Even though the U.S. Supreme Court just ruled in West Virginia versus EPA that on major questions, the executive branch does not have the power to make law.
That's right.
And that's exactly what they're doing here.
So this is a constitutional crisis.
Completely. I mean, this is, you add to what they're doing with trying to mandate abortions in violation of the Dobbs decision overturning Roe. You look at what New York and California are trying to do in terms of trying to effectively overturn the Second Amendment Supreme Court decisions by reinstating even harsher restrictions.
And the press secretary has said on all three issues of energy and abortion and guns, we're ignoring the Supreme Court.
Yes, they've been open. I mean, if they can't stack it, they'll scrap it. And that's what they're doing. They're effectively scrapping the U.S. Supreme Court.
And as you said yesterday, they've announced stacking plans.
Yes, and that's their contingent plan. If somehow the courts do in fact step in and stop this unconstitutional action by the Biden administration and by these other correlated agencies, then they are going to try to stack it and add four Supreme Court.
And by the way, as you know, this happened 15 years ago or so in Venezuela. The government wasn't going along with Hugo Chavez, so they just expanded the Supreme Court with their appointees.
It's one of the oldest games around, is that you just change who's on the court. The last time this was threatened was FDR in the 1930s, and he got what he wanted. The court capitulated and went along with him just by his threat to stack the court. So, and partially the threat to stack the court is intended to intimidate the court.
Hasn't it backfired?
So far it has. I mean, what we saw from this Supreme Court at the end, there were a lot of decisions they could have stepped. It probably worked in part due also to the poor appointment of Barrett in the election context, but it didn't work in the religious context. It didn't work in the Second Amendment context. It didn't work in the vaccine and mandate for employee context.
It's very heartening. So does this mean the court is somewhat independent? Or
Justice Thomas is now the heart of the court. And
I admit that. He's the real Chief Justice.
Exactly. He's the guy who is the spiritual leader of the court. And as long as he is the spiritual leader of the court will go in the right direction a lot more often than not. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a robust, populist, independent
And the left even admits that. They say impeach him. He's the leader.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's why they're, in fact, what are they doing? They're trying to use January 6th to go after Justice Thomas by going after his wife.
Which will only piss him off more.
Great, it did. I mean, if they would have studied his background, they would have understood there was no chance. You know, a great documentary about him, great family history. Probably one of the few working class people to ever make it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Has, you know, old independent political roots.
That's right. Even average white people couldn't get in the court. He's a true grassroots guy.
Absolutely. I mean, the closest you could get is Hugo Black at times had populist instincts, William Douglas at times, but as a whole, Vincent at times, but only a few. As a whole, the Supreme Court has been an elitist institution. Thomas has broken through it with the power of his intellect and the power of his character, and that is reflected in the very constitutionally oriented decisions he's made. And the reaction of the Democratic Party is rage and effective impotency, which they're trying to replace by just taking unilateral lawless action. And they're going to continue to. I mean, these January 6th cases are also part of that. So
I agree. We'll get to January 6th next segment and then the tax on us that affect everybody. But tying this executive power grab that they're waffling on to the NDAA with H.R. 4350 that says he's a dictator and controls domestic operations, this to me shows desperation.
Oh, completely. And it's a sign that anybody running for Congress should be talking about if they're going to really drain the swamp. If they're going to really drain the swamp, no more special emergency powers given to the executive branch of the government. We need to scrap all of these. The emergency powers should be limited, like some legislatures have done. Some legislatures have stepped up to the plate and radically reduced the scope and scale of emergency powers of their governors in the states that got so widely misused and abused in 2020. We need that at a federal
level. Emergency power brought Hitler to power.
Exactly. Absolutely. The Weimar Constitution had one fatal flaw. It's considered the greatest constitution in the history of continental Europe, and its great failure was it included an emergency exception within it. Our forefathers had the wisdom to include no emergency exception in the
U.S. That's right. That's why they always say, shall not be abridged. But expanding on that, you understand it as a well-known constitutional lawyer. The general public may not fully get it, that emergency equals dictatorship. So anytime you're hearing we have emergency powers, you better look out.
Absolutely. That's all. It's always been a threat. It's always been a danger. Emergencies should have been limited to 72 hours max for things that are truly an emergency. And if even then, because the reality is you could always...
Well, they're using nuclear war stuff from the Cold War as the pretext for this.
That's exactly right. And so that they're using every like you go back to the trilogy of infamy and what was it? They used public health. They used a foreign war and the combination of those two justified taking away every.
Now they're using climate and race war and economic collapse and disease.
Yeah, it's always going to be something disastrous, something dramatic, something impactful that will be the scary fear-mongering tactic and technique to seize power. And that's all this is. And this is the biggest effort to seize power. AOC previewed this years ago when she was getting fake arrested yesterday. She previewed this when she talked about how we need to regulate everything in terms of the size of your home, how you paint your home.
And she blamed the Capitol Police saying they're involved in January 6th.
Exactly. Blamed everybody except herself and the Democratic Party that was institutionally behind what took place.
And they're fundamentally frauds, like doing fake arrests, fake migrant centers. I mean, these people just are fake. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. We are real.
This is a short interview that Victor David Hansen had about wisdom. Have we lost our wisdom, you know? Are we all mixed up? Is this society on the way down or breaking up or what? And this was a very short interview, but it was a very good one with Victor David Hansen. And then we're going to go to an extended, you could say, discussion that Robert Barnes had about the Steve Bannon conviction just recently, convicted for perjury and so forth. You know, refusing to testify, I think it was, contempt of Congress. But anyway, we're going to go next with this Victor David Hansen and about some of the wisdoms that we've lost.
So are those hard times of today creating strong men? Gosh, I hope so. Joining me now is Hoover Institution Senior Fellow Victor Davis Hansen. Sir, welcome to the show. You know, what good is a playbook, Victor? You know, the playbook the Reagan administration had of tax cuts and sound money, if we're not going to use it and just walk ourselves into another crisis? I mean, are we just doomed to this cycle of stupidity?
Well, I think we has to be narrowed, Dan. It's the left has sort of rejected the entire idea of conventional or received wisdom. I mean, it used to be that Democrats agreed with Republicans that you had to have a border with unique customs, traditions, civic culture. They don't believe that. There is no border. It's nihilistic. They used to believe that there were two genders. There were a few people that were dysphoric. They were transvestites. They had were transsexuals. But they were not a third sex, so you didn't go all the way to the point where people were in the opposite locker rooms with different genitalia, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't exist anymore. There used to be an idea that if you printed money and you had fewer goods due to supply chain problems or labor shortages, you had inflation. Modern monetary theory said no. And finally, you know, critical race theory or critical legal theory suggested that if you have laws, they're constructs, they reflect the particular interest of the white male ruling class, and therefore they need to be ignored. Whereas the ancient conventional wisdom said, you know, if you steal a candy bar, you have to be punished, because not that candy bars are essential to civilization, but the idea that you don't steal anything is. But this administration and the left have blown up all of these conventional wisdoms. And it's sort of like the 80s, but it's much more intense. I don't know whether COVID or the lockdown accelerated the phenomenon, but this party was the people in the 80s that were on the fringes, and they were pressuring the Democratic Party to go left, and the Democratic Party had had McGovern, and then they'd had Carter, and that those were, you know, disastrous, and then they would nominate Mondale. That was a disaster, and finally, the only answer to Reaganism and the solution and the remedy was they tried to emulate him with Bill Clinton, tried to talk like he was a conservative. And that's where we are now. They're going to either change or they're going to destroy their party, and hopefully not us with them.
Well, that leads me to my second question. You may have answered it in advance, but maybe there's a silver lining to this, right? I mean, we had, what was it, the Democrat Leadership Council, after they got crushed twice by Ronald Reagan and lost to George H.W. Bush. They said, okay, this isn't working. We had Rudy Giuliani in New York after the crime rate exploded, and people said, we've had enough of this. Do you think the silver lining is that finally, that, you know, politics is a kitchen table issue? It's hitting the Democrats at their kitchen table, and maybe there's some kind of renaissance of common sense?
I think so, especially because there's one big difference from the 80s. The Democratic Party had this narrative that they were the party that gave immigrants assistance and federal support and empathy and therefore open borders. That was their constituency. But in fact, they hate the middle class and the lower middle class. And what's happening, we've got 40 or 50 million immigrants, many of them so-called non-white, and they're trying to be upwardly mobile, and this party despises them in two ways. It doesn't care about the effect upon them in terms of energy, gas, diesel, job inflation. All of these issues they don't care about, and yet they're central to the Hispanic community, for example. And then second, they advance issues that no one cares about, but particularly immigrants find aggravating and annoying, and that are things like radical climate change, radical third trimester abortion, radical gun control, radical transgenderism. And the result is that they have alienated one of their prime constituencies, which they couldn't afford to alienate because they'd already alienated the white middle class and the white lower middle class. So I think that's going to really hit them in the next midterm and presidential election, because people in the center and the right are going to say, wait a minute, you're not so liberal at all. You're kind of, I don't want to use the R word, but you don't seem to care about people of color that are aspiring to be like your bicoastal elite. So that's a real vulnerability in there, and you can feel it among the Democratic ranks. They're starting to get a little paranoid about it.
Yeah, you see it in the poll numbers amongst Hispanics as well. Victor Davis Hanson, thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
Victor David Hanson is very, very astute at what's going on in the country. He works closely with Hillsdale College and Hoover Institute. So anyway, he's a very, very important person to listen to. And coming up next is what Robert Barnes had to say about the Steve Bannon recent conviction by a jury up in Washington, D.C. And he discusses, this is quite an extended piece, but it's worth listening to because of the legal technicalities involved in their prosecution of Steve Bannon that Robert Barnes is bringing out. So it's very important to in his discussion here to understand how these courts are operating. So here we go with Robert Barnes discussing the Steve Bannon recent conviction by a D.C. jury.
Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. This is Robert Barnes guest hosting. Steve Bannon found guilty by a D.C. jury. In the bottom half of the hour, we will be discussing what does that mean? Does Steve Bannon have options? Is he going to prison for an extended time period? What impact will it have on the January 6th cases? What impact will it have on the institutional media narrative for January 6th? We'll discuss that and more in the bottom half of the hour. But it's good to discuss first the context of the District of Columbia presiding over these cases. This is a case of the swamp getting to judge the swamp. And is that an effective manner to enforce constitutional liberties in the country? Well, let's just look at cases since 2016. Since 2016, there have been actual rioters, actual violent trespassers in the District of Columbia, but what distinguished them was that they were not on January 6th. They were in the inauguration of 2016, when they were breaking glasses in buildings, when they were destroying cars, when they were setting off car bombs, when they were making threats across the city, when they tried to, in fact, attack Deplorable, which I was a co-sponsor of, one of the events at the inauguration of popular supporters of Trump. They tried to gas bomb the National Press Club in the event co-sponsored by Mike Cernovich and others. And including James O'Keefe was there for Project Veritas, James Hoff for Gateway Pundit, a wide range of people. Jack Posobiec was there. Peter Thiel was there. A range of people were there who could have been harmed that night. What happened to all of those Antifa rioters from 2017? Not a single one of them served a single day in federal prison. Grand juries refused to indict. Prosecutors and agents refused to investigate. And then juries refused to convict. And then judges refused to sentence. The same pattern continued in 2019 and 2020 when we had the Summer of Love riots in Washington, D.C., where the White House itself was under direct, true insurrectionary threat with people right across and outside the White House trying to commit violence against the White House, trying to commit violence against White House staff. Do you remember when people spoke at the Republican virtual convention held from the White House and Senator Rand Paul was violently attacked outside by a raving mob? And then, of course, you get to the wondrous BLM riots of the summer of 2020 that in the name of lifelong criminal George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter movement, which was mostly a movement that has now been exposed as the fraudulent movement that it in fact is and was engaged in riotous violence, so riotous that it made the 1960 style riots in Washington, D.C. look like small change by comparison. Even institutional media sources admitted this on their social media feeds, with the city aflame and looking like a war zone from something in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, more so than what happened on January 6th. So here you had riotous violence, but what happened? Was there mass prosecutions? Was there mass punishments? Was this insurrection treated as such? No, once again, pretty much nobody served a day in prison for the riots of the summer of 2020. What about the people who took over the Senate building, either for climate change politics with AOC, or even more dramatically, in the context of the Kavanaugh hearings, where they were literally harassing senators walking to their elevators? These are people who clearly committed trespass. Did any of them face criminal prosecution or criminal punishment? No, not a single one. Even though they occupied the building, even though they were committing legal trespass, they were in a place they were not legally authorized to be, even though they were actually truly trying to obstruct a judicial and congressional proceeding in that context, a congressional proceeding to affirm a Supreme Court justice, one of the most seminal obligations that it has, none of them faced any criminal indictments, any criminal investigation, any criminal punishment. But it continues.
The same set of folks that have targeted the January 6th defendants for denial of core constitutional rights, their First Amendment right of freedom of the press, their First Amendment right of freedom of speech, the First Amendment right of freedom of association, the First Amendment right of freedom of association, the First Amendment right to petition your government for the grievances that you have, your Second Amendment rights of self-defense, your Fourth Amendment rights against illicit searches and right to privacy, your Fifth Amendment rights to due process of law, your Sixth Amendment rights to be able to confront your accusers and have a speedy trial, and your rights to a meaningful trial by an impartial jury. All of those rights have been violated in the prosecution and punishment of January 6th defendants. Compare just the punishment. The lawyer who committed massive fraud and perjury as part of the Russiagate investigation, the man who was caught doctoring documents that went to one of the highest special courts in the country, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, that lawyer who was caught red-handed with proof in the emails and documents and texts themselves, with no meaningful defense, who had to plead guilty, how much time did he serve? Try none. He did not serve a single day in jail. Meanwhile, elderly grandmas with cancer are being sent to prison for months and often being placed in hardcore facilities as part of their punishment and imprisonment, while others have been waiting for their trial and maybe waiting for years longer for their trial in a special D.C. gulag, as has been reported by both Darren Beatty of Revolver and Julie Kelly at American Greatness. So, and then we have the Sussman trial, one of the very few cases where, in fact, Durham actually meaningfully pursued somebody who was involved in wrongdoing in the 2016 campaign, weaponizing the judicial and investigatory federal law enforcement process, including its spy capabilities to spy and surveil illicitly on the Trump campaign, and then to defame Trump publicly, and then instigate and inspire the very dubious Mueller inquiry that was itself a hoax, as the former president repeatedly noted, and correctly so. What happened to Attorney Sussman, who was caught red-handed lying to the FBI by the admission of every document and piece of testimony in that case? What did a D.C. jury do in that case? Well, the judge who presided over the case, the same judge who issued a ludicrous sentence to Dr. Simone Gold for simply being inside the Capitol without a special permission slip of Nancy Pelosi, that same judge allowed people to sit on the jury who had kids who played with Sussman's kids. This D.C. contaminated jury pool, what did they do? They quickly came back and acquitted him. There was nobody who reviewed and assessed the case that thought there was any possibility of his acquittal under the circumstances and the evidence and the law established in that case. It made a mockery and a joke of the jury pool. The grand juries are a joke in the District of Columbia. The trial juries are a joke in the District of Columbia. And unfortunately, the judiciary has too often and too easily been complicit in that joke of a justice process in the District of Columbia. That is why some of us are suggesting that if the people running for Congress are serious about draining the swamp, and this includes President Trump's 2024 campaign as well, need to include as part of draining the swamp that the swamp can never again be the judge of the swamp. As long as the swamp alone gets to judge itself, there will be no justice in the District of Columbia. There will be no draining of the swamp as long as the swamp determines what water goes in and out of that swamp. So if we're going to meaningfully drain the swamp, we need to scrap the District of Columbia as a federal judicial district. That is entirely a congressionally crafted and created process. It was never intended at the time of our constitutional founding for there to be a special district where the swamp gets to govern itself. So when we come back, we will evaluate what does Steve Bannon's guilty verdict mean. Does it mean the end of Steve Bannon? Does it mean years of imprisonment for Steve Bannon? Does it mean permanent disgrace for Steve Bannon? Or does he have a right to appeal? Does he have a right to challenge it, a right to contest it, a right to bail pending appeal? That and more after the break.
The number one selling category in supplements worldwide is fat burners, is weight loss formulas. And listen, there are hundreds of them out there that work, but most of them do it in a toxic way. Ladies and gentlemen, we went out and did deep research on the safest, healthiest ways to take your overall body's metabolic system and your metabolism and turn that clock back by turning up your metabolism. Ladies and gentlemen, Diet Force does it in a clean, healthy way. It's amazing. I've almost lost 40 pounds the last 3 months just using the samples of it. But now it's come into the InfoWars store and is ready for sale to you and your family exclusively at InfoWarsStore.com. Diet Force from X7, exclusively available at InfoWarsStore.com for 40% off. I want you to experience Diet Force for yourself. I can't wait for the reviews because it's worked great for me. I don't care if you work in a cafeteria or pump gas or whether you're a farmer, a rancher, a doctor, a lawyer, or a millionaire. Fortune and Money Magazine have all done these profiles. You see it every year. 30 different tax returns, 30 different answers. 50 different tax returns, 50 different answers. And almost all of them just screw you over, especially the big firms and the big tax groups, because they're part of the system and they don't want the general public understanding this and knowing this. So it's a very important situation with inflation, all the things out there hurting everybody, to be able to do things tax-wise that's legal and lawful that allows you to keep more of your money. We wouldn't even be here if I hadn't gotten great tax advice in the last few years. The only way you fail is not writing down the URL, JonesTaxRelief.com, one word, JonesTaxRelief.com, or call 833-900-4285, 833-900-4285.
There is nothing, there is no more epitome of free speech than right here. And that's what people recognize and resonate with. And as Ward said, you're not going to find a better place for information. You might not agree with everything. You might not agree with all our perspectives, but we cover all the information. And there's nowhere else really that does it like we do here. Thank you for that, Ward. InfoWarsStore.com, by the way. The products he mentions, InfoWarsStore.com is where to get them, folks, and we do have the best supplements. I mean, just like we try our best with our news coverage and our information, we do the best with our supplements as well. I mean, look at the hair and beard support formula. Folks, this is a joke. I mean, we're giving this thing away. It's 75% off. By the way, it works for me, in case you haven't noticed. The hair and beard formula is working for me quite well, I might add. Quite well. My barber appreciates hair and beard support for men. I go and see him quite often now.
The globalists are fighting around the clock to destroy the family, to destroy heterosexual relationships, to annihilate our marriages. And the studies are all clear. The number one cause of marital splits is that there's problems in the bedroom. And the number one issue men have is erectile dysfunction. Ladies and gentlemen, the left makes big jokes about this because they don't want people having lasting, good, loving relationships. They want to break up society. And we are so excited to have the number one natural male enhancement pill in the world available as a major sponsor now. Go to TheIronPatriot.com today. TheIronPatriot.com and watch the instructional video, look at the science for yourself, and then get a bottle of InstaHeart. It's discreet shipping. I've used it. It's amazing. And it's not just for folks that have problems in the bedroom. This also enhances it. So again, get yours today at TheIronPatriot.com.
Leading a frontal assault on the lies of the New World Order, it's Alex Jones.
Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. Robert Barnes guest hosting today for the bottom half of the hour. We're going to be talking about Steve Bannon found guilty. Does he have any relief? Does he have any remedy? Or is this the end of the road for Steve Bannon? We'll be talking about what his remedies may be in the next segment. In this section, let's talk about what he was convicted of and how unusual the charges were and how he was denied any fundamental right to defend himself in and at the trial. First, what he was charged with was two acts of contempt of Congress. He was issued two subpoenas by the January 6th Select Committee investigating the January 6th event. The subpoenas said demanding he produce documents and that he testify in person. His lawyer responded to that subpoena, explaining that there were major constitutional issues with the subpoena. First, they asserted executive privilege objections and explained that that executive privilege meant he could not testify to Congress about what they were looking for him to testify to, nor produce those documents unless he received a waiver from President Donald John Trump. They responded with just sort of a dismissive response. And so then he waited and believed, apparently, that that they would work out some sort of negotiated outcome or disposition in the case. But they never did. They never issued a new subpoena. They never corrected or clarified what information or documentation they were seeking. Instead, they made a referral to the Justice Department to prosecute him for contempt of Congress. Let's talk about how rare contempt of Congress charges are, and let's talk about some people who committed real contempt of Congress, real lying to Congress, real obstruction of Congress, who were never prosecuted or punished. So contempt of Congress itself is, there's some people that say that any decent law-abiding American should by instinct have contempt for Congress, given the way it has often and so easily ignored both the interest of the public and the constitutional constraints on its duties and tasks. But even putting that aside, whether or not contempt should even be allowed for this investigatory function of Congress has always been, at least in some degree, in dispute and controversy. Because Congress is supposed to be a legislative body, not an executive body, not a judicial body. Congress isn't supposed to be investigating anything. Congress isn't supposed to be judging anything. It's supposed to be writing laws, spending money. The power of the purse is supposed to be its only power, not the power of punishment, not the power of the military, not the power of the sword, not the power of the judiciary. And yet they are usurping that role with this January 6th committee, claiming to be investigating facts for the purposes of legislation. What legislative purpose did Steve Bannon's testimony or documents provide? There wasn't one, and everybody knows there wasn't one. This was fundamentally, at its core, a misallocation of power in the first instance. Congress should not be recognized to have subpoena power to that it can utilize in this way. But courts have been reluctant to intervene and often allow the Congress to get away with whatever they want. If you want to challenge it or contest it, frequently you have to go to court to do so. That's part one of the issues with this. The second part was the committee itself. There are certain rules that govern what makes a legally constituted committee of Congress. Simply being a member of Congress doesn't mean anything you do is an action of Congress. Being even having the Speaker of the House's blessing doesn't mean what you're doing is an action of Congress. For it to be an action of Congress, what needs to happen is it has to abide by the rules of Congress. And the rules of Congress require that any committee be either previously formed or formed with the appointment of a ranking minority member appointed by the minority leader. Here, that did not happen. This is the weirdest congressional committee probably ever formed in the history of Congress. It does not conform to the rules of Congress. It's a joke of a committee. It's a parody of a committee. And it's a committee that by its very nature did not have clear lawful authority to act in the name of Congress, such that disobeying a piece of paper sent by them purporting to be an enforceable subpoena did not by law make it by necessity an actual legally enforceable subpoena of Congress. That was the second set of issues, but it wasn't the only one. As developed at trial, it became clear that it was unclear who actually signed or even wrote the subpoena. The only person who had authorization to do so was not some low-ranking legal staff member who's never been elected to anything, never been appointed as an elected official to anything or by elected officials to anything, but is simply a staff lawyer on the committee. The only person whose testimony counted at the trial was just a staff lawyer, and this staff lawyer could not even testify to who exactly wrote the subpoena, who exactly came up with the idea for the subpoena, who even signed the subpoena. So in order for it to be a lawful subpoena, it needed to be a lawful power of Congress to have. It's not clear this Congress had such a power to investigate this precise issue, or Steve Bannon in particular. Needed to be a lawfully constituted committee of Congress. That, too, was seriously in question and in doubt. And last but not least, it needed to be issued by the person with the lawful authority to do so. And even that was in question. On top of all of that, there were other robust defenses available to Steve Bannon, at least in theory, that many lawyers, including his own counsel, assumed that he had, which was here he was relying upon the advice of his counsel as to how he would comply with the subpoena and his own understanding of the Justice Department's own legal memorandum and the executive branch's own and the president, past president's own memorandum that identified and articulated when you could assert executive privilege. So he had what's called a reliance on counsel defense and a reliance on what can be called a mistake of law defense, which is applicable in a range of contexts such as criminal tax charges when the issue is criminal willfulness, and criminal willfulness was at issue here. However, the district court judge said that under D.C. Circuit precedent, he could not allow Steve Bannon to present any defense on whether or not he relied upon counsel, any defense on whether or not he relied upon executive privilege, any defense on whether or not he relied upon the government's own memorandums on when you're supposed to comply with a congressional subpoena if issues of executive privilege are present. So, in fact, he wasn't even allowed to subpoena the very people in his criminal trial, even though there's a right of cross-examination and confrontation built into the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution. He was denied his right to even subpoena members of Congress to challenge and contest whether or not this was a properly constitutionally authorized congressional subpoena in the first place, including the committee chair himself. None of those people testified at trial, and every effort of Steve Bannon to subpoena their documents or subpoena their testimony was deprived and denied by the district court, and based on the district court's understanding of D.C. Circuit law. And that's because the D.C. Circuit is a swamp protection racket at the judicial level. That's the sad reality, as we have witnessed time and again over the past half decade. That net led to the charges being brought of contempt of Congress, two counts, one count for not producing documents in response to the subpoena for documents, another count for not producing himself to testify in person at the hearing on the date set by the committee, allegedly. And as he was not allowed to present any substantive defense, was not allowed to subpoena the key witnesses in his aid, this basically gutted him from being able to present a meaningful defense. And many of us predicted that it was a foregone conclusion in this district, in the District of Columbia, given the politics of Steve Bannon, that there was no chance a district that voted almost 95% for Joe Biden and that is obsessed with January 6th and sees it as a personal attack on them because so many of them work for the federal administrative state. It's important to note that D.C. and its suburbs are now one of the wealthiest areas in the entire world, thanks to these parasitic lobbyist relationships with people that work inside and outside of government and with a rotating door. So when we come back, we will discuss, does Steve Bannon have a chance? Is he doomed? Can he appeal? Can he get bail pending appeal? What will this mean for Steve Bannon's future when we come up next? Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. This is Robert Barnes, guest hosting. In this last segment, we are going to be discussing whether Steve Bannon has a chance and a hope on appeal for relief or remedy, or is he going off to federal prison and how long? But before we get to that, let's talk about what I mean when I say that the justice system in the District of Columbia is as ugly and as corrupt as the swamp itself. Let's just go back to recent memory. First of all, when was the last time somebody was prosecuted for contempt of Congress in the District of Columbia? Try 1983. It was almost 40 years ago that anybody's been prosecuted. Let's talk about some high-profile examples of high-ranking government officials who committed clear contempt of Congress by Congress's own determination and never faced criminal prosecution or criminal punishment for their actions. And these included meaningful, consequential, misleading and deception and deceit and prevention of information and obstruction of the congressional proceedings on areas that Congress did have a lawful committee, where Congress did have constitutional oversight authority. First, look at Mr. Brennan himself. What was Mr. Brennan caught doing when he was at the CIA? Try illegally spying on Congress to cover up and obstruct an investigation into the illegal torture that the CIA had engaged in under President George W. Bush. This was all continued under President Barack Obama. What happened for his contemptuous actions towards Congress, which actually materially obstructed a constitutionally authorized committee doing their constitutionally authorized duties? Nothing. No criminal punishment, not even a criminal prosecution, not even a meaningful criminal investigation that we know of. Up next, well, then you have Mr. Clapper, the man who made Edward Snowden into the whistleblower he became. Why? Because Mr. Clapper went before Congress and to the questions of a Democratic senator, flat out lied and said that there was no spying going on the American people and the American public through the NSA or anybody else. Of course, that was pure perjury. That is a classic version of contempt of Congress, obstructing the proceedings, hiding information and documentation, misleading them so that they cannot materially perform their constitutionally authorized task of a constitutionally authorized committee of a clear question asked by an elected member of Congress. Was he criminally prosecuted? Nope. Was he criminally punished? Nope. Then we move forward to Eric Holder, the attorney general himself, who with Fast and Furious and other operations was trying to flood drug cartels with illegal guns that ended up killing Americans, including American law enforcement, as a probable pretext for gun control legislation, and when caught doing so, refused to comply with congressional subpoenas of, again, constitutionally supported congressional committees doing constitutionally authorized oversight tasks of the executive branch. He refused completely to comply with many of the subpoenas for documents or testimony, was found in contempt by Congress himself, and yet once again faced no criminal prosecution and no criminal punishment for his actions. But that would not be all. We get to move forward again to the IRS commissioner. In a case that I was partially involved in, the IRS commissioner was caught not once but twice committing two major massive criminal violations, weaponizing the Internal Revenue Service to go after political dissident groups. But that wasn't all. It wasn't just the targeting of Tea Party groups and other groups raising questions about illicit IRS activities, people the IRS mislabeled as tax protesters. They would properly call themselves the Truth in Taxation movement, just raising questions about the legal scope of the IRS's power and the constitutional constraints on that power based on traditional interpretations and definitions of the words income and tax, as well as other activities, but also going after various Tea Party groups, any groups that was raising money for nonprofit purposes to engage in public activities that they didn't like. But not only that, in addition, the IRS was using, with Barack Obama's help, weaponizing Obamacare to make the IRS the enforcement mechanism of Obamacare. And why was that significant? Well, the IRS was going around gathering everybody's private medical records. Indeed, in a case I brought, the biggest Bivens class action in American history, the IRS had seized and stolen 60 million medical records of more than 10 million Americans, including high-ranking baseball players, film producers, film directors, screenwriters, actors, and every judge in the state of California. And knowing whose wife, whose kid, which judge, which official had a secret undisclosed psychiatric condition, medical condition, addiction, other related problems, they had J. Edgar Hoover's wet dream of a blackmail file. That was also under investigation by two separate committees based on my lawsuit. What did the IRS commissioner do? She refused to produce documents. She refused to produce and provide meaningful information. She was found again by Congress to be in contempt. Was she ever criminally prosecuted? Nope. Was she ever criminally punished? Nope. So now let us get to Steve Bannon, the first person in almost four decades to be criminally prosecuted and now criminally punished for contempt of Congress by a committee that has constitutionally questionable authority, doing constitutionally questionable activity, by a committee that can't even clarify who even signed the subpoena in the first place when there were legitimate defenses Steve Bannon was stripped of. Well, first is the next part of the proceedings will be motions for an acquittal despite the jury verdict, which the judge said that he will hear, based on there being inadequate evidence for a reasonable jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt Steve Bannon guilty of both charges. The next thing will be motions for a new trial based on evidence that was precluded and excluded from the case, where the court has an opportunity to correct some of the questionable decisions made by the court that would reinstate a new trial for the case to occur. If the court denies both of those, then the case moves to sentencing. Under the sentencing guidelines, there's a minimum sentence of at least 2 months, 1 month for each charge. And then on top of that, the judge can sentence up to a max of 2 years because both of these are misdemeanor offenses. So he could, Steve Bannon could serve between 2 months and 2 years in a federal prison, for doing something that, no one else has been prosecuted or punished for in almost 40 years, in four decades, after being stripped of his defenses. On top of that, what the judge can do, and Steve Bannon can request, is bail pending appeal. He has unique issues, as the judge himself has recognized. The judge himself has noted that the law of the D.C. Circuit doesn't often make sense. Much of it is very old, based on old decisions, because, again, nobody's faced this punishment or prosecution in almost 40 years. So there hasn't been much appellate law on whether a mistake of law defense applies in this unique circumstance. Could it be considered a mistake of fact defense about the applicability of some of these privileges under the unique circumstances present here? Could the issue of whether this congressional committee was even constitutionally authorized to be in existence, constitutionally authorized to issue this particular subpoena to this particular individual, but whether or not it was constitutionally authorized by who signed the subpoena, whether those evidentiary issues and legal issues can, in fact, be contested and challenged on appeal as part of a robust appeal. And as part of that, the judge can grant bail pending appeal, given that the sentence may be less time than it would take for the appeal to be exhausted and resolved. A typical federal criminal appeal can take anywhere from 6 months to up to 2 years to resolve. So in Steve Bannon's camp, what should happen is the judge should grant bail. The judge is conscientious. He'll grant a verdict of not guilty despite the jury. He'll grant a new trial. But it's unlikely that the court in D.C. has the political courage to take that action, even though this district judge is a Trump appointee who has raised questions about the nature of this very prosecution and has been one of the few judges to question the January 6th cases, particularly in the obstruction context, saying that the law didn't even apply. So there is some hope that that may happen. If it does not happen, this judge is likely not to issue a high sentence, likely to be on the lower end of the scale, probably somewhere between 2 months and 6 months, and then is likely to grant bail pending appeal, which means, given the length of the appellate process, Steve Bannon has publicly stated his commitment to take this case to the Supreme Court of the United States to clarify the scope of congressional authority, whether the swamp can just do whatever it wants, whenever, wherever it wants, weaponize whatever it wants, wherever it wants, through this unauthorized congressional committee, ransacking a person's private life and prosecuting them for politicized purposes. Is that okay still in America? Or are we still America and that's not okay? He's going to take it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. That may take so much time that it may be that by the time Steve Bannon is facing a potential punishment in an actual federal prison, the president of the United States may be one Donald John Trump in 2025. And as President Trump has committed to, he is going to pardon every single person wrongfully targeted in these bogus January 6th cases. And that will probably include a second pardon for the one and the only Steve Bannon, because the outcome of this case should not be federal prison for anybody asserting their constitutional rights and remedies.
That concludes our first hour for this Saturday night. And we just hope each and every one of you got some really insights into this. Robert Barnes is just a very, very fine attorney, and he has it down pat about the law and so forth. And we're just trying to protect the interest of some of these clients. They're being torn asunder. But anyway, God bless each and every one of you for listening out there, and good night, and good luck on everything in the future for you. Good night. God bless you.